Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Rebecca Martinez. This week, Wyoming's senior senator Mike Enzi was surprised to learn he'll be facing off against Liz Cheney in what's expected to be one of the most heated Republican primaries in the nation. Matt Laszlo reports from Washington that right now, the Republican Party is wrapping its arms around Enzi.
It's been some time since Cheney has been on the ballot in Wyoming. But in 2014, voters get to decide whether they want the former vice president's daughter, Liz, to represent them or whether they want to give Senator Mike Enzi a fourth term in Washington. In her YouTube announcement video, Cheney subtly tried to tie Enzi to President Obama.
Instead of cutting deals with the president's liberal allies, we should be opposing them every step of the way. We can stop President Obama's policies, including those that are hurting Wyoming most. We can roll back the power of the federal government. We can lower taxes. We can stop the infringement of the EPA and other federal agencies on Wyoming's agriculture and energy producers.
That announcement and not-so-hidden jab were a surprise to many, especially to Enzi, who had to fend off a swarm of reporters at the Capitol before agreeing to talk to Wyoming Public Radio.
It's kind of interesting that about 30 minutes after I put out a release saying that I intend to run, that she put out one saying that she was running.
Enzi says Cheney lied to him before tossing her hat in the ring.
She said that if I ran, she wasn't going to run, but obviously that wasn't correct.
Cheney said this week that Enzi is mistaken. Personal dispute aside, Cheney's plunge into the race also shocked Republicans in Washington. Wyoming's two other federal lawmakers are firmly behind Enzi. Senator John Barrasso says he admires Cheney, but that he couldn't disagree with her decision more.
I have great respect for the entire Cheney family, for the vice president, for Lynn, and for Liz. I think Liz has a fantastic future. She's very solid. I think this is the wrong race at the wrong time.
Like Barrasso, other Republicans in D.C. are also voicing praise for Cheney. Here's Arizona's John McCain.
I like her very much. I think she's a very fine person, and I think she's done an excellent job.
As for who McCain will back, he says there isn't even a question of whether he and his colleagues will get behind Enzi.
I think you're going to see the entire Republican conference rally around him because of the respect and appreciation we have for him. And that has nothing to do with who challenges him.
Others are a little punchier while defending their longtime friend. Here's Kansas Republican Senator Pat Roberts.
I think that probably Liz Cheney, who I respect as an articulate participant on Fox News, she should have stayed in that job.
Robert says Cheney's skills as an analyst won't translate well in the austere Senate.
I mean, you can make speeches all you want on Fox News, but make the same speeches here on the floor of the Senate, you'll never get an amendment passed.
If Cheney wins, she'll likely join the ranks of senators like Libertarian Rand Paul and other freshmen who are shaking up the dusty Senate. Even so, Paul says Cheney doesn't have his support.
I don't have anything really to say about Liz Cheney so much as that I will be supporting Senator Enzi, and I've told him I'll do anything I can do to help.
Cheney is well known in D.C., partly because, until recently, she lived just outside the city. She's also helped many new senators win their races, including Arizona Republican Jeff Flake. So does Flake feel indebted to Cheney?
No. I'm glad. I'm sure she won't ask me or others to get involved to there's two good Republicans.
It's not just Republicans coming to Enzi's aid. Washington State Democrat Patty Murray has sat across the negotiating table from Enzi and says she has great respect for him, even though she rarely sees eye to eye with a conservative.
Mike Enzi is what I would call, I don't want to say something good and put him in danger.
Murray's not too far off. At a press conference this week, Cheney offered a glimpse into her strategy in the race, paint Enzi as a part of the Washington political class that's frustrating so many people in the state.
You know, right now, what I see out of Washington is an awful lot of going along to get along.
Enzi is known as a workhorse. His quiet demeanor makes him stand apart from all the show horses in the Capitol. But because he's old school and likes to forge compromises, he's now opened himself up to a challenge from the far right. But Enzi says the barbs and accusations aren't going to change him.
I won't be doing anything different than I've been doing. Getting the opinions of the Wyoming people, and traveling Wyoming, and doing my job out here.
A big question now is fundraising. Cheney is well-connected nationally, and she's expected to tap into her father's expansive fundraising network. That means big money could come pouring into Wyoming. Enzi is an accountant, but he readily admits that doesn't mean he's good at soliciting donations.
Money raising's always been a problem for me.
Enzi is going to get some help from the National Party, though. Kansas Senator Jerry Moran runs the campaign program for Senate Republicans. He says their group is already planning to open up the checkbook for Enzi.
We'll see how this race develops. Every state will have its own features. But our support will be there for Mike.
The Wyoming Republican primary for the Senate seat is now shaping up to be one of the most watched and possibly one of the most bitter races in the nation. That means Wyoming is going to attract a lot of national attention and lots of campaign cash. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
Thanks to the Affordable Care Act, a number of things are changing concerning Medicaid in Wyoming. Jan Stahl is the Eligibility and Operations Administrator for the Wyoming Department of Health. She says the changes will take place January 1st.
One of those changes is that Medicaid will increase the income limits for children between the ages of 6 and 18. The current income limit for those individuals is 100% of poverty level, and beginning on January 1st, it will be 133% of poverty level. In addition to that, there are some changes to children who were previously in foster care, some eligibility for them. The one thing that we will not have January 1st of this year is the optional expansion of Medicaid for all adults under 133% of poverty level.
And that's a debate still to be resolved, right?
That is. That will be a legislative decision. And if we do get an expansion here, they will have to make that call for us.
Talking about the kids a little bit, I mean, that actually sounds very exciting. But one of the things I do seem to recall from maybe past discussions is that sometimes children that are eligible don't always get signed up. Is that right?
That's correct. We know that we have a number of children who are currently eligible for Medicaid or who are eligible for the Children's Health Insurance Program who have never signed up for the program. They've never completed an application and attempted to get that coverage. So at the same time, we feel that we'll probably have a number of these children also coming into our program just because of the increased awareness of the option for them to do that, and also because of the publicity and the marketing that the feds are going to do in order to get people into that program. We do still have an individual mandate coming at us on January 1st, and we think that will drive some of those people to seek insurance that they may not have in the past.
Now, am I right, there will be more adults also in the system?
We'll have more adults in the system. We don't expect nearly as big of an increase because we're not going to have that optional expansion for adults.
Jan Stahl visiting with us from the Department of Health. My understanding is also there's going to be some new ways to get people into the system and maybe some new technology. Can you talk about that?
Definitely. We're all very excited about a new eligibility system that we're currently in the process of developing. We are set to implement that eligibility system on October 1st of 2013, just in time for the required open enrollment period for health insurance. And we have a vendor who's building that system for us. It's Northrop Grumman. And we've been working with them for the past year on getting this system into place. What it'll do, it's a system that will allow people to apply online 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It will also, depending on their circumstances, it may be able to give them a real-time eligibility determination. And what I mean by that is from the time they log into the system and they push the button to submit their information, it could be less than 15 minutes for them to actually find out if they qualify for Medicaid or CHIP. In addition, if a person applies and then they are over income for Medicaid or CHIP, we'll automatically connect that information to the federally facilitated marketplace to see if those individuals will qualify for the advanced premium tax credits.
Perfect. Jan Stahl, a pleasure chatting with you again, and thank you for joining us on Open Spaces.
All right. Thank you.
Later in the show, we'll talk to a blind lawyer and triathlete who'll be speaking in Jackson Hole this weekend. But first, we'll talk with Governor Meade about water quality and health care. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio. I'm Rebecca Martinez.
And I'm Bob Beck. Wyoming Public Radio's Irina Zhurov caught up with Governor Matt Meade to check in about some big changes in the state in coming months. She first asked about the Environmental Protection Agency's report on contaminated water in Pavilion and the state's takeover of the study. Although the entities involved in the study have previously expressed skepticism over the EPA's findings, Governor Meade says he has no doubt that the state study will be unbiased.
You have to first look at where the EPA study was going, and we just recently heard that, you know, there's going to be another delay. And so when I hear people say, well, you know, we should have gone with EPA, this is an issue that I inherited that's been going on and on and on, and we've had no conclusions that we can rely upon. And so that's why I think you saw the EPA when we reached out to them and said, listen, we want to get this done. It's important to the Citizens Pavilion. It's important for Wyoming. It's important to industry that they were eager to do this. The fact is, I take exception with people that say, well, DEQ somehow is not going to do a legitimate job. I mean, if you look at what DEQ does and what Director Parfit and his predecessors have done, I think they are very unbiased. They do the best work that they can. But the advantage of having it in this state, in my view, is that we're going to get answers. And that is important for the citizens. But it's also important. We want to know what's happened up there. And you know, if there was an expectation we're getting answers from EPA, I would just point to, you know, this has been going on for some time and we don't have answers. And it's time that we get answers for the citizens and for the state.
And so will the study be peer reviewed?
Well, what we know now is that whether formally or informally, that study, whatever it is, whatever it shows to, is going to be reviewed. There will be people who I think pour through it multiple times with a fine-tooth comb. But I have faith in our DEQ to get it done and to get it done properly.
So you don't think it's necessarily important to get it peer-reviewed if you kind of trust the agency that's going to be handling it?
I think that DEQ can do the study without it being peer-reviewed, and I will have confidence in it. But as we hire outside experts, I think that's something that could be determined. But whether or not it's peer-reviewed, I have confidence that DEQ is going to do a good job.
The Wyoming Oil and Gas Conservation Commission has been discussing stricter regulations for natural gas flaring. Where do you stand on that issue?
Well, I think it's always a challenge because on the one hand, you don't want to say we're going to start closing down production because we don't have a way for flaring to occur and for well completion. On the other hand, I think the commission, and you know, I'm not speaking for all of them, but at least from my perspective, there's a level of frustration where the companies come in time after time and say, geez, we don't have any way to deal with takeaway capacity. And so I think it's appropriate that we're taking a look at flaring. And there's some companies, small companies and medium-sized companies and even large companies, that do very well all of the time, and then there's instances where, you know, they keep coming back and saying we need additional flaring. And it's not only the question of the environment, it's a question of lost revenue for the state, and so I think it's appropriate we take a look at it.
There's been some delays in some key components of the Affordable Care Act. What do you think? Is that good for the state, or does that change how you feel about the Affordable Care Act and what it will do in Wyoming?
Well, I don't think the delays in and of themselves are good. I think it's appropriate to delay, though, if you don't have the answers. And so this recent delay on the portion of the Affordable Care Act, I thought was appropriate because you don't want to put employers in a position where they don't know what the requirements are. You don't want employees with that level of uncertainty as well. And, you know, last year when I was talking about the Affordable Care Act, I said I do think it's important before the state decides which way we're going to go to get more answers. Last year, we were having trouble getting any information. This year, I think the federal government is putting out what they know, but it's such a heavy lift because it's such a huge document that I think they're having trouble getting it all together. So it's appropriate to delay when you don't know what the rules are going to be.
And Wyoming has long struggled with a shortage of primary care physicians. Where do we stand on that front? Are there any initiatives to get more doctors into the state?
Well, there is. It's not just primary care physicians. It's nurses as well as healthcare providers in all areas that is a challenge in a rural state like Wyoming. And that's why I think, as you see, you know, last year UW came in and one of their proposals was to cut the WAMI program, and I put the money back in. That is not a solution in and of itself, but I think it's a area where the state can commit to make sure we do our best to recruit physicians to Wyoming. There's not any one thing I think that we can do, but I do think that is an important thing to continue that program and continue to make it strong. With regard to healthcare providers generally, one of the things I think we're going to have to look at is better models in terms of how we get them here and how we provide services. And I think medical homes are a good way to look at that, because I think it leverages everyone's abilities and lowers costs, and I think ultimately provides better health care for a patient. And we've been supportive of medical homes, and now I'm pleased to see that they are growing.
So revenues for the state have been looking pretty strong for this year, and you've already brought up potential pay raises for state employees. Are there other investments that you want to look into, considering that state revenues are looking good?
Yeah, well, first, always a word of caution, and we'll wait for the October CREG to come out. But, you know, if things continue as they are, I am interested in raises for state employees. For UW, I think also we need to look at raises there as well. And that is not just a whim. The fact is, for the first time since the earlier mid-90s, the base salary of public employees has gone down. Our turnover rate's gone up to 15%. And so we're seeing the results of not keeping up with what the Hay study shows, which is that in some areas we're not being competitive with our salaries. So that is one area. I'm also very interested in putting money from my SIPA account to provide money for a unified network, which will expand broadband capacity across the state many, many times. And I think that is not only good for education and telemedicine, telecommuting, but I think it's going to provide us additional opportunities to expand the technology sector in Wyoming. Those are two areas I'm looking at. We will have more areas both in capital construction and infrastructure, including money for local government. I'm going to try to make a strong pitch for local government. I don't have a number yet because we don't know what the CREG's going to show, but I think that's critically important that our towns and counties remain strong, because if they're strong, Wyoming's strong.
Okay. And so you'll have probably more details after the CREG actually comes out?
Yeah, we'll have more details after the CREG comes out. And the other part of that, that's sort of the revenue side. The other part of it is the spending side. We've already begun the process of meeting with individual agencies on what they need as they see it for their budget. And if you look back a decade at the number of employees the state has, we have today many fewer AWAC employees, temporary employees, than we did a decade ago. Our overall numbers of permanent employees are up, but a large chunk of that is due to the Department of Corrections. We had previously many of our prisoners out of state, and when we brought them in state and had the new facility in Torrington, Department of Corrections added a number of employees. So the growth line, trend line on a number of employees has gone up over the last decade, but primarily because of Department of Corrections.
Governor Mamie, thanks so much for taking some time to talk.
Thank you very much. Have a good day.
After the break, we'll hear about changes in the Wyoming Department of Education and what it's like to live in Yellowstone in the winter. This is Open Spaces.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Rebecca Martinez. Richard Bernstein is an attorney and triathlete who was born blind. He represents disabled clients pro bono at his family's law firm outside Detroit, and he's an adjunct professor at the University of Michigan. He's speaking this weekend at the Chabad Jewish Center of Wyoming in Jackson Hole. Bernstein's talk, called Vision is Overrated, a Blind Attorney and Athlete, is part of the Chabad Center's Distinguished Lecture Series. I gotta ask, you're in Yellowstone, which is famously one of the most beautiful places in the country, but, you know, since you can't see, tell me what you're enjoying there.
You have the mountains and the rivers. I think the way I experience Yellowstone is you can feel the energy. You can feel the warmth. You can feel the cleanliness. You can feel the spirit. And I think what happens when you're blind is you might not be able to appreciate or understand or experience the physical things. But I think in a place like Yellowstone and Teton and the other beautiful places I've had a chance to visit, you know, while I've been here, I think you can feel the spirit, you can feel the energy, and you can sense the warmth of the people.
Now, you were born with retinitis pigmentosa. Can you tell me what that is?
Sure. Retinitis pigmentosa, it's really just a form of glaucoma. And, you know, I have been blind my entire life. And people are, I think, very curious to understand, how does a blind person experience life? And I think what it really comes down to is, if you've never been able to see, you don't know anything different. I think that my life has actually been very fulfilling in the sense that I don't know any other way of life, and I can't experience life in any other fashion or any other mindset.
How did your legal career get started?
Well, I knew that if I had the chance to become a lawyer, I knew that I could make change. I knew that through the law, you could really do something that was going to have a positive impact on other people. And I want you to imagine what it's like to be blind going through law school. You know, I can't read and write. So what I had to do was I had to literally memorize and internalize absolutely everything as I was in law school. So if it took a traditional student 1 hour to do something, it would take me 4 hours to do something. And when I was in school, I prayed every single day that God would give me the strength and the energy to get through it. And it was so brutal because I couldn't highlight or take notes, and everything was internalized, everything was memorized, and just the effort that went into law school on a daily basis and the intensity that went into it on a daily basis is indescribable. But I wanted to be a lawyer in the worst way. And I promised God that if He gave me the chance to become a lawyer, that I would dedicate my life to representing people with disabilities and special needs who otherwise don't get representation and who otherwise don't get a chance. And so miraculously, I graduated from Northwestern, and then even more miraculously, I passed the bar exam in the state of Michigan, and a promise was a promise.
Now, as an attorney, you've participated in a number of lawsuits to improve infrastructure for people with disabilities. How is America doing as far as having infrastructure for people with disabilities? Better or worse than other places? Do we have a long way to go?
The United States is by far, for a person with disability, the absolute greatest country you could ever live in. There isn't anything that even comes close to what the United States has done for people with disabilities. Now, does that mean that we're perfect? No. But when you look at us compared to other countries, the fact is you see people with disabilities anywhere and everywhere in the United States. When you have a disability, especially a severe disability, you tend to live your life with a greater sense of mission. So for me, I work completely pro bono, which is I never charge for legal representation, and I represent people with disabilities and special needs who otherwise don't have access to our judicial system. You know, I will fight with, like, U.S. Aviation to make sure that airlines are accessible and airports are accessible. You know, I fight with universities, like my own university, where I'm, you know, a professor, to make sure that the stadium was accessible. I fought with the Detroit Department of Transportation to make sure that bus systems in my community are accessible, which led to bus systems being accessible all across the nation. When you have a disability, you need to be incorporated. You need to be included.
Now, it sounds like you really enjoy being outdoors. I mean, you've run marathons before. How did you get into doing sports?
I think what happens when you're disabled is that you get written off when it comes to physical fitness and phys ed. So when I was in school back in Michigan, I never thought I could be athletic. No one ever thought that I could be athletic. Ultimately, what happened was this incredible organization called Achilles recruited me. And they came and they said, Richard, they said, would you ever like to start running? And I said, I can't start running. I mean, I'm blind. How on earth am I going to run? I can't see where I'm going. I live in darkness. And they said, look, we can make this work. We'll give you a team of guides. The guides will run with you. They'll give you directional cues, like hard right, hard left, soft left. You'll hold a rope that connects you to your guide. And they said, just give it a shot. So I want you to imagine what it's like to be a blind person and attempt to go running. You have to learn to trust the people that are guiding you. But what's incredible is that I have done 17 marathons and the full Ironman competition. The full Ironman competition is a 2.4-mile swim, a 112-mile bike, and a 26.2-mile run. Imagine what it's like to dive into a frigid body of water to begin your 2.4-mile swim. And being blind, you're swimming in total darkness. And the only connection you have with your guide is a rope that's connecting you to him. And as a blind person, I can tell you this, you know, without question, that God will always give you what you need when you need it. You'll always have exactly what you need when you need it. You won't have anything more, but you'll never have anything less.
Richard Bernstein is a blind attorney and athlete from Michigan. He's speaking at the Chabad Jewish Center of Wyoming this weekend. Richard, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you for letting me have this opportunity, and thank you for the work you do.
Unless you are new to the state or have lived under a rock, you are aware that the state legislature passed a law that changed the powers of the state superintendent of public instruction and placed a director in charge of education.
Now lawmakers are investigating a report that suggests possible wrongdoing by Superintendent Cindy Hill, charges she denies. It might lead people to worry about education in the state, but lawmakers want you to know that they continue to try and make change for the better.
Over a week ago, leadership in the state legislature made the decision to investigate allegations in a report that suggested Superintendent Cindy Hill misspent federal money, misused the state plan, and, among other things, mistreated employees. The results of their findings could actually lead the legislature to consider impeaching Hill, who has little over a year left in her current term. Hill denies the charges and says it's a witch hunt, and her supporters accuse lawmakers of piling on. Senator Eli Bebout says that charge is unfair.
How can you say you're piling on if you wanted to confirm facts? We're not piling on. We want to know if the facts are, if they're true and the allegations be backed up by facts. That's what we're talking about.
State Representative and Education Committee member Kathy Connolly admits that the Hill business has been a distraction.
When we have the whole reorganization of the Department of Ed and the superintendent duties, when we have all of these lawsuits coming up, of course it's a distraction. I would be remiss to say no, it's not. But I hope that we can finish with it, put it behind us, and really move along with looking at, you know, what's best and better.
For the last 3 years, Wyoming has embarked on an ambitious effort to improve education in the state. Lawmakers are changing state standards. They are implementing major accountability measures for schools and teachers, and they are looking at new and innovative ways to improve learning. The Joint Education Committee recently met to continue those tasks, and House Chairman Matt Teeters was excited.
I think today it felt like we were back in the saddle again. It felt good. We were having high-level policy conversations about how we're going to move forward, and I'm encouraged by that because I think we're all ready to move on with our lives.
Some of those discussions concern getting more Native Americans to graduate and what might be done at lower grade levels to improve that. They looked at how to improve virtual learning, how they can encourage early childhood education for some at-risk students, and how the curriculum for the Hathaway Scholarship is working. He says the commitment to improving education has never been stronger.
Oh, I think we have one of the best systems in this country, and I think as we continue to look at innovative ways to make it better, it's only going to get better. You know, we have a strong commitment from the legislature and the governor's office both to continue high levels of funding, which is important. And now we're looking at ways outside the box, really, to try and dramatically improve the quality of this education in this state.
Senator Jim Anderson says he's waited for almost two decades to see the kind of innovation the legislature is trying to pursue.
What we're doing in education in Wyoming is just not very effective. If you continue to do the same things, get the same result, that's a little bit of insanity. So what we're trying to do is break out of that mold and do things in a much more effective manner.
Anderson says that ever since Interim Director Jim Rose started running the Department of Education, the department has been much more cooperative and has worked with legislators to try to develop their ideas. Rose says with a permanent director, there's more innovation to come.
Looking at a fairly substantial change in the state standards and how we assess those standards with the Common Core and the statewide assessment coming on in 2015, alternative learning environments, distance education, a lot of those kind of things. I think we're on the cusp of some fairly major changes.
Educators and representatives of the State Board of Education also like the new ideas. As one educator said, despite the white noise, things are heading in the right direction. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck.
Although millions of visitors will flock to Yellowstone National Park this summer, Atlantic City-based author and journalist Marjane Ambler is one of the few people who's lived there when the park is buried in snow. The former High Country News editor lived with her husband, who drove a snowplow inside Yellowstone for nine winters during the 1980s and 90s. In her new book, Yellowstone Has Teeth, Ambler recounts stories of terror and wonder during her time there.
When people ask me why I wrote it, I say that there's a lot of mythology surrounding the park. And part of it is that all the books that are written about Yellowstone are about rangers, and almost all about male rangers. So I wanted to show a hidden community of the women who either are rangers or support troops for the rangers, and the maintenance workers. My husband and the people who shovel the roofs, and there's a lot of other people who keep the park operating who normally aren't in the spotlight.
What was the community like and the area around it? I mean, I understand it to be pretty isolated.
Yeah, we were 30 miles by snowmobile from the nearest road, which meant going over Sylvan Pass, or we could go 50 miles to the north or 50 miles to the south if we wanted to get a loaf of bread or a gallon of milk.
There was a passage in the book where you talk about how some of the people that are living in your community give you lots of tips on how to transport groceries safely. Tell me what it was like to go to the grocery store and what you had to remember when you're packing your snowmobile.
Well, we learned a lot from the people in our community. We were mutually dependent. We learned that if you're going to pack milk, you ask the grocery store to freeze it before you arrive so that it won't burst. If you're going to carry avocados or bananas, you put them inside your snowmobile suit so they won't freeze. If you're doing eggs, you put a rubber band with some foam or padding in there. So there were a lot of tricks, but we never did get it completely right.
The book is rich with descriptions of snow. Would you mind reading an excerpt for us?
Often the crunch of my skis and the puffs of my breaths were the only sounds. Climbing the bluff above Fishing Bridge each evening, I learned to hold my breath to listen to the swans, sometimes feeling faint before I remembered to exhale. Looking out over the lake for signs of freezing, it was hard to imagine such a large body of water ever becoming solid. But the next ice age hovered at my elbow. The lake remained frozen for nearly half the year, usually not thawing until late May or early June. The old-timers told tales about haunting sounds from the lake's ice, so we awaited the freezing eagerly.
You've been skiing your entire life. I'm interested how your relationship with snow changed after spending all this time on the interior.
Well, the last year that we lived there, it snowed every week through the 4th of July, and my husband was plowing snow on the 4th of July. So winter was wonderful. I skied every day outside my back door 100 days of the year. The spring was what drove us nuts. It's different now, but at that time it just went on forever, and you got tired of the green and white being the only colors, and yet there was some sensory deprivation.
You mentioned a lot of run-ins or avoiding run-ins with bison. Can you tell me about that?
Well, the bison tend to go to sleep in the middle of the road at night. One incident that we didn't witness but we heard about was this guy plowed into a whole herd of bison, and this calf came flying through his windshield into his lap with two broken legs. And it was a horrible thing. He was horrified by what he had done, but he was even more horrified by all these cows that were crowding around him to see why this calf was bawling. So he dove under a log right by all these nervous little hooves, big hooves, and he managed to survive, but the calf did not. So we didn't experience anything that gory ourselves, but we had some close calls. When you look up at a bison from a squatting position, they fill up the whole sky. They are big. And we learned that if they have their tails up, they're either going to charge or discharge. There's certain things that you learn after you've lived there for a while, but at first, you don't know.
The book offers such an intimate, interesting perspective of such a famous place. Marjane Ambler is the author of Yellowstone Has Teeth, out by Riverbend Publishing. Marjane, thank you so much for coming to talk with me about your book.
Thank you, Rebecca.
Up next, we'll hear about how some Wyoming ranchers observe the age-old tradition of branding. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Rebecca Martinez.
And I'm Bob Beck. The grazing land of Wyoming is currently filled with young calves out to pasture. Calving season lasts through the spring and early summer in Wyoming, and once the calves are born, Ranchers have to brand them to identify which ranch they belong to. Wyoming Public Radio's Irina Zhuroff attended a branding and found that in the 21st century, some ranchers are happily keeping up old social customs during their brandings.
Scott Sims's ranch in the Rock Creek Valley in southeast Wyoming branded a batch of their calves at the end of June.
The brand that we use is called a Lazy Triangle E. Actually, that brand goes back to my great-granddad. It was his brand.
That day, there were over 300 calves. There were three ropers, four sets of wrestlers, two branders, two castrators, and they were giving the calves three different immunizations. That's about 20 people, all told. The group assembled from a handful of ranches in the valley, which all help each other out for their respective brandings.
We've been trading labor doing this probably for the last 15 years anyhow, 15 to 20 years.
Sim says it wasn't always so. His family used a branding table in the past, a metal contraption that holds the animal in place while it gets branded. Using the table requires less labor than the old-fashioned roping and wrestling technique, and a lot of smaller ranches prefer it. But the Sims family switched when a family from Cheyenne came to the valley and convinced them to go back to wrestlers and ropers, traditions as old as the Lazy Triangle E brand itself. Sim says those customs are important for ranching.
We kind of like to keep up the tradition. It's part of our culture and using horses and roping. We'd like to keep that up.
Sim says it's also nice to get everyone together.
Everyone's worked hard through the spring, long days, long nights, cold weather, keeping calves alive, and getting together to brand and work together is kind of a reward for all the hard work.
As the branding gets going, the teams of people work efficiently to provide each calf with all of their necessary shots, to administer the brand and castrate the bulls. Scott's son Shannon instructs the crews.
That should be all of them. Start on the double tags now. Give us a second to warm the irons up, though.
While waiting for someone to come over with the hot brand, a father and daughter wrestling team hold down a calf on the dusty ground. Roger Newkirk is smiling.
It's been done this way for 100 years, so we ought to have it figured out by now. That's my daughter, Cassidy. This is how it gets efficient as tradition.
The Newkirks have been in the valley since 1918 and have known the Simses for about as long. Cassidy has been working at brandings her entire life. The calf gets its brand, and they move on to the next one. The work pauses to take a break, and everyone stands around eating cinnamon rolls and discussing why they prefer this method of branding over the table.
It's a lot more work. It's a lot dirtier. Jump in here, guys. What's all the concerns? It's not near as fun.
It's not the cowboy way. Sorry.
Yeah, okay.
But I've seen a lot more calves limp out of one of them calf tables than you will at one of these.
On a serious note, tradition.
One of the men jokes that he wouldn't even show up to help if they used the table.
Oh, we'd show up, but we'd complain a lot.
Caden Sims is Scott Sims' grandson. He's 10 years old and grew up going to brandings. This year, he's helping vaccinate. He stands around patiently listening to the talk of tables and finally asks,
"What's a table?"
If it sounds like the Simses are purposefully training the younger generations to stick with the older ways, it's because they are. Sim says it's more efficient, less stressful for both animals and humans, and it's good for morale.
We have always tried to be community-oriented, and I think it's a good way to keep communities close to each other. I think as an industry, we're stronger whenever communities are close. And we wouldn't go back to any other way now.
Kagan Sims agrees.
I'd rather do it this way.
When they branded all 300 calves, the entire crew ate lunch together at the Rock Creek Valley Firehouse. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Irina Zhuroff.
You can see a series of photos from our branding on our website, WyomingPublicMedia.org.
We finished today with this essay of a young girl's visit to a ranch. Here's writer, musician, and photographer Jessie Veeder and her essay, There's Nothing Wilder.
There's something about a girl and her horse. Yeah, boys have their toys with wheels, their guns, their tools, their dogs, and look noble and masculine on the back of the beautiful beasts. but it's not the same. I was reminded of this when my 12-year-old cousin from the cities came to visit the ranch for the first time this summer. My cousin is a fiery, sweet, smart redhead who has spent much of her childhood surrounded by pavement, giving all of that animal-loving heart to her declawed pet cat. I love this girl, but I admit I was a little nervous to have her out to this wild place, so far removed from shopping centers and friends and swimming pools. I was worried she would be bored. I was worried that the things I liked to do when I was 12 would not appeal to her. And to top off the unexpected anxiety, it occurred to me that this preteen might never survive without cell service. So the plans I made to walk through the creek beds and pick wild berries and go fishing in the big lake and ride horse were on a list right next to the backup plans of movies and swimming pools and manicures. You know, just in case. But my cousin was not nervous at all. As soon as the car pulled through the breaks of the Badlands and down into the valley of my parents' home, she stepped out and sucked in the fresh air and immediately buried her face in the necks of the two dogs rushing, tails wagging, coming to greet her. I've never seen a smile that genuine. I've never seen a heart open that wide. So I took this as my cue and shredded my backup list and made plans to check off everything on the first one, the real one. We had 2 days. So we scoured the hills for choke cherries and plums, got her shoes muddy in the black mud of the creek, caught a frog, went swimming in the big lake and shot a beer can off a fence post. She rode a four-wheeler, she tamed the wild cat, she sat out in the yard with the four dogs as the sun went down on what I hoped was a day of her dreams, and she rode a horse. And if ever there was a moment that needed to occur in the life of a 12-year-old girl, a moment that makes all of the annoying troubles of the world disappear, a moment where complete innocence and trust and hope appears again in the eyes of a girl on the verge of womanhood, it was this one. We walked into the corrals and I pointed out her horse. Her eyes sparked. I slowly and carefully showed her how to bridle the creature. She listened. I gave her the curry comb and she brushed his coat and mane. She asked where horses like to be scratched and her hand reached up under the chin of her animal, and he answered her question as the new four-legged friend showed his appreciation by stretching out his neck and nuzzling her shoulder. And if I thought my cousin's heart was open as wide as a heart could be when her face nestled into the necks of the dogs, I know now I was strongly mistaken about how big hearts really are. But I should have known. I was that girl. I am her. Because there's nothing like a girl on a horse. And until now, I guess I must have thought I was the only one who lost myself completely on the back of an animal who takes your life and carries it across the rugged prairies, through fields of clover and snakes and wild, wild things. I thought I was the only one who threw my heart wholly to a beast who could launch you high in the air with one kick and send you tumbling to the ground, but mostly chooses not to and instead listens as you ask him to climb a hill, go fast around a barrel, and then help you bring the cows home. See, there is a certain amount of trust, a different kind of connection between a girl and a horse. A boy, a man, and his horse have a different agreement. There is a certain amount of power a man is not willing to relinquish to a beast, an understanding between the four-legged animal and the two-legged creature on his back that they will indeed accomplish a task together, successfully, the way it was meant to the man. And the man thanks the horse for his assistance, and this is a wonderful thing. But a girl loves her horse with a kind of tenderness only a woman can give. She longs to understand the animal and knows there are days when all you can do is walk slowly together down the road, no matter how pressing the issue. A girl wants to ride just to maintain a connection with her animal. But when the time comes to run, there is nothing more untamed. There is nothing wilder. There is nothing closer to the wind than a girl, hair tangling behind her, face close to the neck of her beast as they reach for the horizon. And up until now, it didn't occur to me that maybe that sort of wild is in every woman somewhere. So thanks, cousin. Thanks for coming over and showing me that even city girls can open their hearts and let go of their fear and their life and the world as they know it and just ride like the wind.
That was Jessie Veeder reading her essay, There's Nothing Wilder. That's our program for this week. If you want to hear it again, you can find it online at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Anna Rader is our web editor. You can also send us ideas for future programs on that site and sign up for our podcast. For those of you on Facebook, we invite you to become a fan of Wyoming Public Radio News by clicking on the like button. And for news updates, you can follow us on Twitter. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.